Yeah, we go straight into our wrap of the top business stories and helping me to take a look at some of these big stories on this Monday. Snesipho Manindwa, independent market commentator, analyst and CA. Snesipho, good evening and welcome.
Hi, Aya. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great.
Snesipho, I want us maybe to start off here with, this PCR test story. Anybody who's ever had to travel, I guess, over the last few months or so would tell you what a costly exercise it can be, let alone, I guess, getting, you know, things stuck up one's nose. But it seems the cost of what people might be paying for these PCR tests might be a lot lower. This after the competition authorities have come to some agreement with two of South Africa's largest private sector labs, and that is Ampath and Lancet.
Yes, so Lancet have done all microbe tests, but I will say the fact that they were able to drop their price by more than almost half within a second's notice tells you that they've been overcharging and abusing consumers since the start of the pandemic. That is all I have to say about it, because I fundamentally think that I believe that the Competition Commission took their time with acting. They should have acted a lot quicker. But alas, here we are. I was chatting to some of my counterparts in the UK, and they were saying that they were hoping the same thing was going to happen on their side, because they're still paying. I think the price they got was £150. And it tells you that, you know, South Africa, we may be a third world country. Our government cares, so they take their time. They take their time, but slow. But, you know, they eventually get there. They eventually get there. They just take their time. But for me, it really points to the exploitation that was going on. I won't even lie to you. I've spent a lot of money on COVID tests. The fact that they could just drop it. My question is that it wasn't a gradual decrease. They said, okay, it's effective immediately, we can drop it, which tells you that the markup is insane, and they're still going to be making money at 500 grand. That is the thing that shocks me. They'll still be making money, which tells you how much room they truly have.
But I guess the other issue here, Snesipho, is that, you know, the cost of these things is totally, or I guess the price at which, you know, we are charged is unrelated to the cost of actually administering the test. I mean, I think the last time I took these tests, you know, drive in, you know, I mean, it takes less than, you know, less than 3 minutes in some cases. I stick this thing up your nose, take the thing, you pay. But there's nothing for me about the cost of doing it. I mean, the consumables associated with it don't cost 850 rand.
I use model hospitals, the consumables. When I tell you, the thing that's the biggest cost aspect is the human cost, the person doing the test.
But their salaries haven't improved, I'm sure. The salaries of the people administering those tests.
But remember, they've got dedicated resources for this. So they almost have me on the human resource, because the actual consumable part is not where your cost is. It's your people, your capex, your actual capex, because of the, and also the fact that you start prioritizing COVID tests above your normal lab work. My issue is, and this is where I stand, is that you still have scope to go further down. We're not saying don't make money. No one is saying don't make money. But what we're saying is that your money needs to be made in a way that's ethically, considering the fact that we're in a pandemic and we are in a poor country. That is where we're coming from. No one is saying people mustn't make money. That's why they almost have me. But understanding that we're in a global pandemic. So also, if you look at the cost versus the private cost versus the public health care cost, the private, like, you can go to a clinic. I tried going to a clinic, Shana, the queue literally put me off. I saw the queue, you know, when you see the queue as you're driving in that, Shana, you're running the app. There are quite a few clinics. There are clinics. I found there's a list of clinics that DOH can give you. There's a list of clinics you can go to, and you can get the COVID test free. It's just that you're going to wait, and you're going to wait. So, and also, how medical aid works is that if you test positive, you get a refund. If you test negative, and you're over your limit, you're over your limit for the year, you have to pay. So it's sort of like you're dodging. Yeah.
But I guess, Snesipho, the other dynamic here is that because this is a requirement for travel, that effectively many people end up taking the tests at whatever cost these tests are offered to them, because without it, you can't travel.
Yes, and that's the problem. Like I said, exploitation. It's exploitation. Exploitation. And remember when, you know, DOH DOH commissioned the cost of private healthcare. It literally says the same thing. Our private healthcare is extremely out of kilter. The cost of the service versus the cost of actually the quantum, the cost associated and the profitability are two different things, and they are out of kilter. It's like they forget we're in a global pandemic. We're not saying don't make money, but I imagine someone saying I can drop the price by half, almost half, and I still make money.
There's nothing different here from, I mean, when I look at this price gouging from people looting. It's the same thing.
The thing is that, and this is what people need to understand, it's the exact same thing. Corruption is also the exorbitant pricing. It is also corruption because you are using the fact that people have limited options. The reason why I know, out of all the labs, Lancet is the closest to me. The clinic is actually further from me. It's Lancet, and Lancet is in all the public spaces. I'm forced to go there. If I have a work meeting I need to go to, and I need to provide, because you know these days, they want proof of vaccination plus negative tests these days. People want those two things. I have no choice. So again, exploitation, cartel pricing. Why were they all charging $850? Like, why? Different companies, different shareholders, different. And that is where my issue comes from.
It sounds like they sat at a kerkvergadering or something, like the guys who fixed the price of bread a few years ago.
Why were they all charging the same prices? It's like the price of a roll-on is different from a Pick n Pay to a ShopRite. Why were these people all charging the exact same price? I'm just making a simple example just to understand the quantum and majority. And by the way, the people that test the most and are from the ones who are medical aid clients. More than half.
Yeah. So I guess there's also that, right?
The profitability margin.
You know, there's also and I think medical aid funders have been complaining about this. Even in the case of the private hospitals, I think there was a market inquiry about a year ago, complaining about the same thing. This idea of going and raising prices on what are seemingly procedures. I mean, getting this thing stuck up your nose is probably not the most complex or complicated procedure, but you end up getting charged so much. And in some cases, you agree to it because you're not paying for it exactly at that moment.
Yes, and that's also the problem. Like I said, like the main example, like the most example is that I've had blood work done that costs less than a COVID test. That is, to check your cholesterol costs less than your COVID test. Your diet, like to check your sugar level costs less than a COVID test. Yeah. Do a full assessment at Discovery is less. Health assessment is less than a COVID test.
Snezipo, let's pause here for a second and take a quick spot break. But when we come back, I want us to talk about a basic income grant and also, this new joint venture here between RTT and ShopRite Holdings around their on-demand business and in particular their grocery delivery service 6060.
Understand what you need to do.
21 minutes it is after 7 p.m. It's our wrap of the top business stories here on Metro FM Talk. And helping us to do that is Sinesipho Manenjwa, independent market commentator, analyst, and CA. Yeah, and I'd love to hear some of your, experiences of getting these PCR tests done and the costs of doing so. I mean, I had to do one quite recently, for travel purposes. And I must assure you that I can't go in that entire process. That felt complex enough to justify the amounts that were involved. You can send us your WhatsApp voice notes on 079-191-4270. Must get your PCR test for a second, Sinesipho, and take a look at this expert panel that was put together by the Department of Social Development, the ILO, and the UN Sustainable Development Goals Fund. And they are saying there will be no social protection or adequate social protection framework in South Africa if it does not resolve the issues of income insecurity for those who are out of work and between the ages of 18 and 59.
We've been saying this a decade too late, but as we call it, a decade, because it literally boils down to that you need to do. While we are trying to restructure our economy, we need to ensure that people don't starve. And that's literally what it is. It's literally to address people who don't starve, who fall outside the traditional societal safety net. I think when we see the unemployment figures and we see the, and we look at them, and I always say the biggest number to always look at is the number of discouraged workers, that number, and the July unrest. I think was a testimony to what happens when idle hands collide with desperation. And it just needed a spark. It literally just needed a spark.
And you know, when people are no longer, how do I put it, they have no stake in the continuation of any economic order, if they are on the margins of it, in the way that many people, even those who are listening to us, are, you know?
Yes, and then you can factor even that, you can even overlap that to how many of those don't vote. Well, that's part of our political ruling.
And if it's the same level of disengagement, actually.
Same level. And for me, that is where, so your other compatriots, your fellow professional people, as is about, we don't need to name them, fail to understand that aspect. Fail to conceptualize that you are ensuring people don't starve. And people sometimes think grants are one-sided. Ask ShopRite Chickens. How possible the
community
is.
Definitely.
Because and what does that go through? Increasing VAT. Yeah, increasing income taxes. So there's a multiplier effect. But for me, that intervention without the supporting economic intervention is going to have this one-sided impact that they talk about. It will. But for you to have the impact that you want, you need to not also address economic challenges, and you start. So social spending does not just relate to people. It then talks to things like your infrastructure backlog, your enablement. Then you go into enablement. A lot of people, that's what I hate about sometimes your profession, no offense, but you know, I saw one of them today and I'm in a mood.
Look, let's be honest. You remember what happened with the Queen during the global financial crisis? She was like, there are so many well-paid economists, but none of them could not only just predict the crisis, but even have something to say about how we respond to it. So,
CIA's
profession yet, you know?
My whole logic is that people are very committed to having a one solution, let's go for it. You can't have one solution because our economy is multi-structured, multi-failing at each and every income order. So you've got to have a unified and multi-pronged strategy. You having the social grant does one thing. It ensures people don't starve. You then need to create you then need to look at infrastructure spending and going to direct things that are employee engagement so that your number over time goes down from a reliance perspective. And you're also creating, and then you need to localize your development. That is how you do it. It is. There's no other. And by the way, all of these are different schools of economic thought. But our problems are so unique in this day that you've got to do a multi-pronged approach.
And you know, I think, Sinesipho, I mean, the reality, and notwithstanding the very rich debates that are happening within the economics profession, you can't run away from this in South Africa, as you rightfully said, if you look at the fact in July that, you know, let's criminal, cynical masterminds aside, abantu were going to go and steal, you know, sunflower oil, going to go and steal
that's 10 kg of milk. A child on TV was stealing
shoes.
This was not some mastermind getting going to enrich. This was a people were going for basic necessity, and they just needed a trigger. And that tells you that we are literally sitting on a time bomb. And I think we spoke about this on my podcast, where I said, this is our first shock. We cannot allow a second shock to happen. It's one of the things that's why I get so mad about this economic discussion, because the people who are most against it happen to look like me and you.
I mean, the reality of it is that at the end of the day, race question and national question, yes, is important, but I think we're seeing the emergence of a very conservative, black type of commentariat as well. So I think that shouldn't surprise us.
I don't think it should shock us. Colin Goldman was head of Goldman Sachs, and he's like, if we don't do this, if he can recognize it, and all his privilege to have no people, like, if he can see it clearly, that's my argument. I was like, if he can see
it. Yeah, I guess. He's also part of a particular type of, as people say in this debate, pressure group. And I think, notwithstanding his Goldman Sachs connections, I think many people who, would have had a background with him in the trenches would say that they didn't find it surprising. But yes, I agree with you. I found it very surprising that Goldman Sachs can say it, and yet parts of, formerly progressive people in our own government are seemingly so afraid of it. What do you make, Snesipo, just briefly on this one, of, you mentioned ShopRite earlier on, but of what could potentially happen here? I mean, we saw with NetOne, you remember NetOne CPS, where effectively grants were being used to cross-sell people, funeral cover, airtime advances, unemployment insurance, all manner of things, even not retired, two-year unemployment insurance as well. How do we make sure this time around, if indeed we institutionalize the 350 Rand as a starting point towards a basic income grant, that that type of predatory capture of what is effectively a redistributory mechanism doesn't happen?
We have no choice. So basically, our government was dumb enough to allow ShopRite to open in the townships. They don't even have to do exclusion. They're already there. They have the presence of already being there. They don't even require additional capital expenditure. That is how bad it is. Literally, think about where are they located.
Yeah.
Even though you say location, there's even a song, location, location, location. They're already there. So they are they're going to be the most preferred. They will be the most people who benefit purely because of long-term investment that they made years ago. And they are, especially even the ones at Boxers, again, those who are close to public transport, again, where anyone who's in that specific value chain is going to profit. It's not because they'll have to be, they don't even have to change their price mechanism or anything like that. It's literally where I think that the way we've missed it is that having ShopRite as a distribution point, but then localizing their input. That for me would be the real development that's actually going
to. It's for me unsurprising when I said that after the July, or even actually from the start of 2021. We saw major investments and acquisitions, in some cases bolt-on acquisitions, by big retailers, both in clothing and in food, at the bottom end of the market. I mean, remember Mr. Price and Power Fashions? Power Fashions,
from when I go to Uchua, go Matate, you really can't even go into the, oh my God, they're going to be so exploitative. They happen to be there. There's a very, very big difference in that. This is not dependent on them closing contracts. It's literally being there. They're there where the economy is built. And by the way, that Power Fashion acquisition is in lieu of what they see the basic income grant. They're making moves because they can see that the momentum for the basic income grant has been growing.
Exactly.
It started from workers, because the work has been going on for the past 10, 15 years. Let's not, and people have been doing the work. But past July, it went from whispers to now screams. And it means that is the thing. That is the thing. Who reported this? Cyril Ramaphosa, the president of Cyril Ramaphosa, who at the onset says he doesn't believe in grants, is now having to put in front row center. It becomes screams.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think July has also done a significant amount to speed up the urgency of that. But it's something we're going to come back to, Snesipho. So I don't think Masikita Yonga lo Begile. We're going to come back to it with Ibrahim Fakir in the next few minutes or so. But talk to me about this acquisition here, or joint venture maybe, not an acquisition. ShopRite Checkers entering into a joint venture agreement with the RTT Group. Now, this is their current delivery partner for 60/60. They're seeing this as something that will ensure that their learnings, technology, and intellectual property created by Checkers 60/60 will be protected and contained in this venture so that they can innovate and continue to develop their last mile logistics. In simple English, Batin.
Quite simple. Checkers always owns a shareholding in any venture they own. From ShopRite Properties to Hungry Lion, they always show ownership, and then they close it on then they scale it up through their own ecosystem. They're the biggest retailer in the continent. It's basically they always want to own it. They never want to have a service provider. It's the entire business model. It's an ethos. This is from Whitey days. It's literally from Whitey days. If you look at each of the businesses that ShopRite Checkers has started, they've always had a share ownership. They never do service provider, especially when you think about the nuance of online grocery development, and they want to own the IP. They want to grow it inside, and they want to have control.
And they also want to own the data.
So the they want data to own the data.
What
they
you
want
are
to
ordering,
everything.
What is being delivered to your doorstep, what you're even looking at.
At some point, the thing is that they don't want to do what Woolies did. So Woolies wanted Woolies. They're like, we're not going to spend time developing our own IP. We're going to ask Amazon Analytics to do it. Shopify doesn't go to that model. They want to own everything.
Eesh. Yeah.
Once you understand, it's literally the ethos of their brand DNA.
Talking about that brand DNA, Yema, you must know, before I leave ShopRite Holdings, I don't know if this is my correct reading, but it seems, you know, Christo Wiese, Osisnyanya is ShopRite, and seemingly, you know, even though they might want to rejig things and place them in the shadows and the margins, I heard something very interesting here about some options that he's taken out on the shares of the company, and also, I guess, a potential cash windfall for him on the back of a strike price that was much, much lower than where the share price is now, all the way out in 2003. So he got a deal, which was in the books, of course, since then, of ShopRite. And it seems now a few hundred million are due to him.
Yes. He is a celebrating position. He's literally, he literally becomes the second biggest, after this, he's going to become the second biggest shareholder after the PIC. GPS. Remember, he also owns those non-convertible, non-participating, low-par value shares.
I guess our structure says ShopRite.
The voting, because he always wants voting rights. The issue is that from a corporate governance perspective, Christoph Wiese has become toxic in the ShopRite mix. And this comes from, it's part of the consequences of sign-off. He's become toxic. So instead of doing for the better good, because you don't listen, and when you've got money, you've got the power to do this. The way he set it up in the structure is that he's making himself ensure that chairmanship vote, which keeps getting closer every time, it never passes. He doesn't want to. He will leave on his own terms, and he's willing to buy his position in. There's nothing you can do about it. There's actually nothing you can do about it.
Playing marbles with rich people.
When you're rich, you actually have this option. Because remember, a few weeks ago, a few months ago, that ShopRite vote got a bit too close to comfort. That's why it's exercising these options.
Yeah.
These were granted over 18 years ago. Why exercise them now? He was always going to, but he wants them. He wants them because he wants to control.
And he wants them now. He wants. So
because he does.
Yeah, yeah. I think. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
This is not a money thing. This is a control thing. People actually think it's a money thing about him getting richer. It's not. At this point, he has more money than he knows what to do with. It has nothing to do with money, but all about control and not being told, not having people have the option to tell him what to do. This is a pure control structure. Once you make peace with that, people, you'll be a lot calmer.
Okay.
Look how he
We can go on the whole day. No. But let's stay in retail and talk about the latest, I guess, musical chairs out at Inditex, which owns a company that I know many of our listeners are going to be visiting in the next while for their Christmas shopping, and that is Zara. What's the latest there in the world of fast fashion?
So they had a change of leadership, because you know Zara is a family business.
Yes, indeed. It's
a family business. So they had a change of leadership. So one of the things that they've done is that one of the family members, the oldest daughter, he tightened his grip, the founder, and Monica Ortega. Please note, Zara is Mr. Price, but globally. Please note, you only deserve that. I actually need to get this very clear.
And, Mr. Price, here, Oxford.
Yeah, so what he did, they appointed a new chief executive officer, and they also appointed a new non-executive chair, which is one of the family members, the whole family, Martina Ortega. So she was appointed as new non-executive chair, and she's been working for the company for 15 years. She's the youngest daughter, and she's literally been involved in the brand her whole entire life. What was, I think, quite interesting is that this announcement triggered a fall in the share price, which talks to the fact that people don't like these family businesses, these family businesses and family control businesses.
How material is that? I mean, the big selling point of this particular business is that supply chain.
The sweatshop. You mean the sweatshop? Because it's a sweatshop.
It might not be in China. A big part of what they produce might not be in China. But in Spain.
Turkey?
Yeah, best believe. Morocco, Turkey, Spain. Okay, sure. That's how they beat everybody else. I mean, the whole fast fashion model and, the shorter supply chains and cheaper supply chains is the big thing. I mean, what's the family got to do with it?
That's why I call it Mr. Price. Zara's entire brand position is producing high-end fashion of your designer brand at a cheaper price faster than anyone else can do it. So what their value chain was about speed. And how they got over speed, the reason why they were not impacted, even their sales were not impacted primarily by COVID, was because their supply chain wasn't stuck in China. It was in the Middle East. But it does not mean the pricing of Zara means that they're not paying above fair wages. That's why they switch up. Same WhatsApp group. Same exact WhatsApp group. And that's what they've been very, 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 very good at. But they've been struggling in the U.S. because they've been hit by the Chinese competitors of Shein and your likes of your Fashion Nova, these global e-retailers who don't have brick and mortar. Because Zara still predominantly is a brick and mortar business. So even if you think about it, like one of the things that I thought was amazing, their sales this year in 2021 were 10% higher than 2019. They've recovered. They've bounced back. Done incredibly well.
Look, I mean, I guess, Nesipo, they also haven't faced as much of the supply chain concerns of having much of your supply chain in mainland Asia. Certainly a bit of an issue. I mean, we see it in the clothing and textile sector as much as we see it in semiconductors. But we're going to have to leave it here. It's a very interesting story I always find when it comes to what's happening in the world of retail. And I guess a lot happening at the start of this new week. A lot of retail news here at home and abroad. Snezibo, thank you very much for helping us take a look at that.
Yeah.